Our producer, Anne-Marie Baldonado, books a lot of our movie and TV guests, so we sent her to the Toronto Film Festival to scout out interesting movies and future guests. She saw 20 movies that were at the festival. It started last Thursday and concludes this Saturday. Now that Anne-Marie is back, we asked her to tell us about it. So, Anne-Marie, in the world of film festivals, what's the Toronto Film Festival's niche?
Well, first of all, it's known as a really people-friendly festival. You know, unlike Sundance or Cannes, regular people go to the screenings. Regular people from the city buy the tickets. They line up. And so they're seeing these movies with film critics from around the world and also with studio execs, either people who have films here or people who are looking to buy films to distribute. They're all seeing these movies together. And the rep about Toronto crowds is that they're very generous. You know, just think about if you're a regular film goer and you get to see a movie that no one else has seen and maybe the star of the film is in the theater with you, you're going to be sort of generous to it. And lots of studios like to bring their films here because of the fact that they're probably going to get a better reception than like at a festival where mostly it's film critics in the audience or something. But also it's sort of the unofficial kickoff of the Oscar season. You know, it's the fall and studios release the films that they think are going to be kind of art housey or films that are in Oscar contention. They bring them here and launch them and hope that showing them here to generous crowds can give them a little bit of a buzz and a little bit of a push that will sort of propel them to the end of the year and get their films nominated. And this year in particular, it's important because of the economic climate. There are fewer films. Studios have fewer films that they're releasing. And at the same time, the Oscars have expanded their list of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10. So, you know, that's a lot of spots to fill. So I think people are thinking if they make a big impact at the Toronto Film Festival, they might be on that list.
Okay. So are there films that are getting that Oscar buzz at the festival?
Yeah, I would say the film that is getting the most buzz is actually my favorite film of the festival, a film called Up in the Air. It's Jason Reitman's third film. Jason Reitman's first two films actually both showed in Toronto and did well. The first is Thank You for Smoking, and the second was Juno, which 2 years ago did really well, Oscar-wise.
The film Up in the Air is based on a novel that I really love by Walter Kern. And the novel, a lot of it is set on an airplane because it's about somebody who has accumulated all these frequent flyer miles and his goal is to get more. And I read the book on an airplane, on several airplanes. And so I just really loved it because there's so many descriptions of like airports and lousy fluorescent lighting in airports and being next to passengers who are talking to you when you don't want to talk and so on. So what's the movie like?
Well, actually, I think Jason Reitman really captures what you're talking about. But he uses the book as a jumping off point. And in a press conference, he was talking about writing the film. He's been writing it for a few years now. The Kern book came out in 2001. And he said when he originally started writing it, I should back up and say that this traveler, the main character of Up in the Air, who's played by George Clooney, his job, he's sort of a corporate hitman. He's the guy that companies hire to do their firing, the character would say, when they don't have the guts to do the firing themselves. So when he started writing this movie a few years ago, you know, it was a different economic time, and he was writing those firing scenes for comedic value because his films always sort of have a comic bent to them. But as he was writing it and the economic climate changed, firing scenes, you know, they're more real now. It's more what's going on now. And he couldn't write them that way. So he ended up actually putting ads in local papers where they were filming in different cities in the Midwest, trying to find people who had been downsized, who had been let go. And he uses those interviews with these people who have been laid off throughout the film. And the film, because it deals with corporate downsizing, it just feels like the right film for now. Just sort of seems to fit what's going on in the economic climate.
I'm really glad the adaptation was made because the novel came out just about on September 11th, and everything had changed in terms of airports and flying, and this really kind of funny, perceptive book that had so much to do with flying made no sense anymore.
No, and
so it got lost completely.
Yeah, I think Reitman turned it into something else. And I think he's pretty much a shoo-in to get a nomination for adapted screenplay.
So Up in the Air was your favorite film at the festival. Is there another film or two you'd like to mention that you think our listeners should watch out for?
Well, I did like the Coen brothers film. It's called A Serious Man. It's people are saying that it's their most personal film to date. It's about a college professor in the 1960s, a Jewish college professor who's going through some hard times. His wife wants to leave him. He's having trouble with tenure, and his family doesn't understand him. And it's a film that people are kind of assuming, and probably correctly, that it's the most autobiographical. For one, it features a 13-year-old boy who's getting bar mitzvah, and people sort of assume that it's somehow based on the Coen brothers' experiences as children. So it might be a hard sell in that there aren't any stars. You know, the last film they had Brad Pitt in it. A lot of the critics liked it coming out of the festival. Oprah was there as well. She was not in a film, but she came to support a film that she's an executive producer for, a film called Precious, which is also getting a lot of Oscar buzz. It's a film about an obese African-American teenage girl who is abused and actually carrying the second child that she's had with her father. So it's based on a best-selling novel by the poet Sapphire, it's just also getting a lot of buzz for its performances.
So you think we'll have some good movies to talk about on the show?
Hopefully, yeah, and some great guests.
Well, Emery, thanks for reporting to us on what you saw at the Toronto Film Festival.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Anne-Marie Baldonado is one of our producers. You can read more about her experiences at the Toronto Film Festival on NPR's Monkey See blog at npr.org. And you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Primetime television gets a major jolt tonight when Jay Leno's show debuts at 10 p.m. It's one of the most anticipated TV events of the year and the source of lots of speculation on how the longtime Tonight Show host will do in this earlier time slot. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, it's a big gamble for NBC.
Just listen to the Hollywood chatter. A radical move. Unprecedented. Possibly a watershed moment in primetime programming. In the TV industry, Jay Leno's big move is by far the most talked about event, and NBC, which is in last place in the ratings, is promoting it everywhere. Billboards, bus shelters, popcorn bags, TV, the web.
Radio call at 1 a.m. that said, "Grandma's drunk and ready to fight."
The Jay Leno Show, new comedy at 10, 9 central.
The Jay Leno Show promises to be a mix of new segments and old favorites from The Tonight Show, like The Monologue.
They showed a doctor on the news last night. He said, "These women show no remorse." Well, of course not. They're full of Botox.
And Leno's popular street interviews in the segment Jaywalking.
Can you name two of the founding fathers?
Founding fathers of what?
NBC is moving Jay Leno to primetime in part to save money. Those scripted dramas that dominate the 10 o'clock hour are really expensive. NBC can produce 5 hours of Jay Leno for what it would cost for 1 hour of drama. But what about those loyal late-night fans? Will they want Jay Leno earlier?
America loves him, and he's a hard worker.
Scott Carter is executive producer of HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher.
I think for a lot of particularly perhaps older viewers, of which I am quickly becoming one, to get Jay Leno an hour and a half earlier each night is a good thing, not a bad thing.
But Scott Carter agrees there will be challenges.
To have to do 5 shows a week for 40 or 42 or 44 weeks a year eats up a lot of guests.
The competition to get those celebrity guests was war between Jay Leno and David Letterman. Now add Conan O'Brien, who replaced Leno on The Tonight Show, to the mix. NBC just upped the competition for the A-listers. Jay Leno at 10 o'clock also means it'll come on just before the local news.
Live local breaking news at 11.
I think the hardest part for me is knowing that he was murdered.
preceding the news could prove tricky for Leno and his comedy writers. Sherry Ann Brill is Senior Vice President of Audience Analysis for the advertising agency Kara.
You could have, you know, this great funny joke and the viewers are laughing, and then all of a sudden the news comes on and it's, you know, 20 people dead from gunshot fire.
Sherry Ann Brill is also skeptical that the new Jay Leno show can get higher ratings than popular dramas like CSI Miami.
Ron deserves
You're
to
not
die.
Answering my question, did you threaten his life?
The 10 p.m. block of dramas is a formula so entrenched on the broadcast networks, the arrival of a comedian like Jay Leno will be a shock to the system. But NBC is desperate because they're in last place. Sherry Ann Brill thinks it's good they're taking a risk, but
it certainly won't outperform the competition on the other networks. But I think it will do well enough for it. You know, NBC to make money.
But Jay Leno has faced stiff competition before. Scott Carter says, remember his battle to beat David Letterman?
Dave was doing much better for a long time, and then Jay just kept making adjustments. He lengthened the monologue, he changed the set. He just kept tinkering with it until he became the clear ratings winner.
Nobody really knows how completely changing the menu on prime time will work, but Jay Leno is planning one heck of a launch. The first week, guests include Jerry Seinfeld, Kanye West, Tom Cruise, Halle Berry, and Miley Cyrus. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Nice group, but Jay Leno's move to primetime has one group in Hollywood feeling more than a little anxious. Here's Morning Edition commentator and screenwriter John Ridley.
If you're dreaming about becoming a high-priced Hollywood writer, you might want to dream on. The Writers Guild of America West, that's the union that represents the bulk of movie and TV writers, recently released their annual report. It reads more like the script of a horror movie and a low-budget one at that. So let me just cut to the chase. With fewer and fewer movies finding their way to the box office and more reality shows on TV, writers are suffering a near 50% unemployment rate, and year to year, earnings are down almost 20%. That's the lowest level for both in 5 years. Now, how's that for a dream factory? Living in a company town, the wretched stink of the engine of creation grinding to a halt is everywhere. I know in my travels, movie lots, once full of energy, are now populated by scribes who schlep around their intellectual property, Willy Loman style, hoping for the sale, that one sale that'll put them back on top. And if things are bad for writers now, they're only going to get worse. Jay Leno and NBC are taking a lot of flack for annexing 5 hours of real estate previously devoted to some of the best scripted television in the history of television. And, yeah, cable TV has helped breach the gap as the new destination for quality fare, but cable shows literally aren't half of what network programs are. The writing staffs tend to be half the size of network shows, the pay half as much, and the seasons run about half as long. All that adds up to 3 times the hurt for writers. And what does this mean for viewers? Well, not a whole lot. If you're into The Biggest Loser or movies based on comic books, but if you liked everything from Hill Street Blues to ER to Network to The English Patient, expect to see a lot less entertainment that's reliant on the strength of the written word. A Hollywood script has long been the holy grail for writers. Some of the most gifted scribes from literature to stage were lured west with the enticement of celebrity and pixie dust. Raymond Chandler, Graham Greene, Norman Mailer, David Mamet. Masters all, but all still seeking to master one of the most difficult feats of amusement. The delicate balance of all the elements necessary to make filmed entertainment. Way back in 1926, Citizen Kane screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz seduced playwright and novelist Ben Hecht to Hollywood with a telegram which read, "Millions are to be grabbed out here, and your only competition is idiots." Well, there aren't millions to be made anymore. And the competition now is anything, and it doesn't necessarily have to be well written.
Screenwriter John Ridley is founding editor of ThatMinorityThing.com. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
Last night, Amy Poehler scored a rare primetime TV doubleheader.
She guest starred on the season premiere of NBC's Saturday Night Live Weekend Update Thursday, anchoring the fake news with Seth Meyers. And then, immediately after that, she starred in the second season premiere of her own NBC sitcom, Parks and Recreation. She plays Leslie Knope, the deputy parks director in the fictional town of Pawnee, Indiana. Amy Poehler was a regular cast member of Saturday Night Live from 2001 to 2008. In her final year at SNL, she received a lot of attention for co-anchoring Weekend Update, her portrayal of Hillary Clinton during an election year, her Sarah Palin rap, and her increasingly evident pregnancy. Terry spoke with Amy Poehler in May. Here's a clip from last night's show. Poehler, as Leslie, imported a pair of penguins to be married in a special ceremony at the local zoo. Except, she mistakenly selected two penguins who were male. An angry constituent comes to complain.
Well, what can I do for you and those fine people at the SFSF?
Well, you could resign if you're up for it.
Oh, you're serious?
When you performed a marriage for gay penguins, using taxpayer money on government property, you were symbolically taking a stand in favor of the gay marriage agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry, but hold on a second there, Marcia. That was not my intention at all.
Well, why else would you marry penguins?
Because I firmly believed that it would be cute. And it was.
Leslie, are you married?
No, not yet, Marcia. Soon, probably. I have a plan, but no, not now. Not dating anyone yet. Focusing on my career, but...
I thought so. So you couldn't possibly understand. But when gays marry, it ruins marriage for the rest of us. So either you annul the wedding, or I'll publicly ask for your resignation. You know what? I'm so terrible with directions. If I'm headed to the parking lot, do I make a left out of here or do I go right?
It's a left, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Annul the wedding.
Amy Poehler, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you here. Let me ask you to describe your character on Parks and Recreation.
Well, Leslie Knope is a misguided optimist. She's kind of a person in local government who believes that things can happen really fast and big changes should happen. So she's kind of, I'll refer to her often as an open-faced sandwich. She's very easy to read and a little sloppy. She's a I really like playing her because she's she overpromises, but she's also very kind of well-intentioned and there's nothing cool about her.
One of the things I like about the character is that her ambitions are so small. Like when she gets her own subcommittee, it's like she's been elected president of the United States.
Right. Well, Leslie has a life plan. And, you know, when she explains it, it's over very small little increments. And, you know, she talks about how her next step is getting on the city council and then, you know, becoming perhaps a, you know, the right-hand man of the lieutenant governor of Indiana. And then that governor dies and then she takes over. And then, you know, after a scandal, she runs for senator. And it's just a very slow process for Leslie. And so these small little victories are low stakes but high excitement for her.
Parks and Recreation was created by Greg Daniels, who also created the American version of The Office. And there are similarities between the two shows. They're kind of companions, one set in a paper office and the other in a small town government office. But they're both in that mockumentary style. Have you watched The Office a lot? And on the whole, is it better to have seen or not seen much of The Office?
Ever since I knew that I was doing this show, I stopped watching The Office, which was hard to do because I love that show and the performers on it. But I had to stop because, well, it's hard to enjoy comedy in general right now when you're on. It's very hard to watch comedy when I'm doing a comedy show because I either watch a show and I love it and I'm jealous, or I watch a show and I see all the problems with it and I'm angry that I watched it. But that's for my shrink, not for you, Terry. I was a huge fan, and then I had to stop just because it's kind of too weird to kind of watch it at the same time.
So, do you miss Saturday Night Live?
I do. I mean, I think it's kind of the most exciting job I will ever have in many ways. And I certainly miss that exhilarating pace of it. But the opportunity to kind of stay in one place and play, you know, a character that grows and changes is really exciting as an actor. And SNL, there's this very, you know, it's a machine. And when you jump off the train and it speeds away and you kind of get the dust in your face and you cough and you wave goodbye to your friends and you think, oh, no, you know, there it goes. What a ride while I was on it. But I might need to, you know, I might need to walk by the side of the tracks for a while. But I do. I miss it a lot. And the people that work there are tremendous at their jobs. And so, yeah, I do.
Now, how did you get the part of doing Hillary during the primary?
Well, I think I started doing her in like 2004, 2005. I tried to do her a couple of times. And certainly, it probably was just, it was a process of, you know, sometimes when you're doing an impression on that show, it's just kind of because you maybe have a take on that person or you sound or look like that person. I think that I probably got the job because everyone else just wasn't paying attention that week because I certainly don't sound like her. We were similar, but in the way we look, but I didn't really have a take on her. So it took a while to figure out how to play her.
One of the sketches you did as Hillary Clinton was a debate sketch in which Obama was depicted as someone who the media really pampered and catered to. And as Hillary, you pointed that out. And then Hillary Clinton, the real Hillary Clinton, took that and ran with it. Mm-hmm. Basically quoted it in her stump speeches and said, look, you know, this is what Saturday Night Live is saying. And then she shortly after that appeared on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
In what was called like an editorial response. She basically said, I was told not to be flattered by this and that this is not an endorsement of me. Mm-hmm. And let me play the sketch that ensued after that when you and she were together on stage.
I still enjoyed that sketch a great deal. Because I simply adore Amy's impression of me.
Oh, well, my ears are ringing.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit.
Why,
but I
thank you.
Do want the earrings back.
Oh, okay.
Do I really laugh like that?
All right,
sir.
So, how's the campaign going?
Oh, the campaign is going very well. Very, very well.
Great.
Why? What have you heard?
Nothing.
It's Hillary Clinton with my guest Amy Poehler on a sketch on Saturday Night Live. So what was it like to be on stage with Hillary? And I should mention you were, you know, dressed identically in brown tweed jackets with black piping.
Much kudos to our wardrobe department who makes those jackets in about 45 minutes. These people are geniuses at what they do. And, you know, you'll get a call, you know, so-and-so, you know, someone's going to play Donald Trump and he has to be a vampire and this has to happen in 20 minutes. And like any live show, the people are so great because there's no – it's like an emergency room. There's no one stands in the middle of the room and starts screaming, we're never going to do this. This is never going to work. It'll never happen. We don't have enough time. It's just okay. Everyone says, okay, and it gets done over and over again in the best way. But, sorry, I forgot your question.
Oh, what was it like to be on stage with Hillary Clinton?
Well, it's always strange to be dressed like someone and stand next to them. That's always strange, unless you're, you know, a twin and your parents, your mother dressed you for the day. But, so it was... it was exhilarating. It was fun.
Can I point out, not everything that you did about her was flattering. So was that awkward? Even making fun of her laugh, which you did on stage with her. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like, okay, I've said some things and done some things that are probably a little offensive to her, and here we are together?
Yeah, that certainly happens. You know, there would be times when I heard that her camp were excited about something they saw, and I would say, uh-oh, be careful, because you might not be excited this week. You know? Oh, boy. You certainly have that moment where you're like, oh, boy, sorry about that. Or not sorry about that, you know, depending on what you do. But it's interesting that you point out the laugh, just because that, I think, is an example of she doesn't really laugh like that. But the perception of her laugh was interesting, that people believed that she laughed like that. She didn't. She actually has a kind of like a very inclusive and open laugh, and it's kind of warm. But that laugh came from her trying to keep things down and kind of not being able to believe all the stuff that she had to deal with. And so that's how that laugh came to be. But it really isn't anything like how, the way she laughs. And so it's kind of interesting to, because I don't really do a very good impression of her. So it was kind of an impression of the impression of her that was seemed to be working or seemed to be getting laughs.
Amy Poehler speaking with Terry Gross in May. Poehler's NBC comedy series, Parks and Recreation, began its second season last night.